This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqarah, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of a grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The headlines: UN dismisses Israel's claim about sufficient food supplies in Gaza as ridiculous, saying all bakeries are closed due to lack of fuel and flour. The Yemeni army conducts a new anti-U.S. operation targeting an American aircraft carrier and its warships in the Red Sea with missiles and drones. And also in our headlines, Iran rejects Trump's threats about using military force to bomb Iranian nuclear sites, saying there is no military option regarding the country's nuclear program. Hello and welcome, everybody, here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story: the Israeli regime continues its deadly and devastating assault on Gaza, killing and injuring more innocent Palestinians. Since the early hours of the morning, the death toll from Israel's relentless bombardment has risen to at least 21. An airstrike in the southern city of Khan Yunis claimed the lives of at least 13 Palestinians, including a child, and left several others injured. The situation in the southern city of Rafah has also deteriorated with intensified airstrikes and artillery shelling, killing at least 5 people. Meanwhile, the Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, Israel Katz, announced plans to expand the military's ground operations in Gaza, aiming to seize large areas to be added to the so-called buffer zones in the Strip. Since mid-March, Israel's renewed aggression has killed over 1,000 Palestinians. The overall death toll from the genocide in Gaza has reached nearly 50,400. The United Nations has rejected Israel's claim that there are sufficient food supplies in the besieged Gaza Strip. This after the World Food Program reported the closure of all its bakeries across the territory. The world body's reaction followed the regime's claim that despite the ban on aid entry to Gaza, there is enough food for a long period of time. UN spokesman Stefan Dujarric dismissed Israel's allegation as ridiculous, adding that UN supplies in Gaza are almost finished. He emphasized that the World Food Program has closed its bakeries due to lack of flour and fuel. Meanwhile, head of the Gaza Bakery Association was quoted by local media saying that all bakeries in Gaza have indefinitely ceased their operations due to a critical shortage of flour and fuel. The official described the current situation as an ongoing hunger war. Since March 2nd, Israel has not allowed any aid to be delivered to Gaza, saying the ban will continue until Hamas releases all remaining captives.
The Gaza Strip is facing a severe humanitarian crisis as Israeli blockade, now exceeding a month, continues to prevent the entry of essential aid, including food, fuel, and medical supplies.
The Gaza Strip is going through the most dire circumstances ever. The famine is back again, even more severely, as 25 bakeries stop completely. This current crisis is unprecedented, as this is the longest time span of closure of the Gazan crossings by the Israeli regime. This in turn has caused the shortage of flour and fuel needed for the bakeries to operate.
The United Nations World Food Program reported that all bakeries in Gaza have ceased operations due to the acute shortages of flour and fuel. The WFP emphasized that a bread, often the only accessible food for many families, is becoming unattainable, warning that famine is a serious risk looming for the Gazan population.
All the bakeries closed today because of the continuing closure of crossings. All what was stored in our warehouses by the WFP have been consumed completely. So here we are now, without any ingredients there is no way we can work. We used to consume 250 to 300 tons of flour daily, which was less than the actual amount needed for the population. Now there is no choice for us.
The dire humanitarian crisis is further exacerbated by the continuous Israeli military aggression that not only claims the lives of thousands, but also makes survival for 2.2 million Gazans a struggle.
As the blockade endures, the people of Gaza continue to face an increasingly desperate struggle for survival, with starvation looming as a significant threat besides the continuous Israeli aggressive attacks. Ghad Ibrahim, Gaza City.
Israeli forces and settlers continue their violent raids on towns and cities across the occupied West Bank, injuring more Palestinians and damaging their property. In one of the latest incursions, three Palestinians were injured by Israeli settlers in the town of Douma, south of Nablus. Hundreds of settlers who were protected by the regime's forces also burned two livestock farms and three vehicles. Three Palestinians were shot with live and rubber-coated steel bullets during confrontations that ensued. The attack, in a separate incident, a group of extremist settlers attacked the Al-Aouja Spring in northern Ariha under protection of Israeli forces, injuring four Palestinian citizens. The settlers attacked Palestinians with pepper spray before closing the spring area, claiming it was a military zone. Violent attacks by Israeli forces and settlers on Palestinians have greatly increased in the West Bank following the resumption of the regime's genocide in Gaza in late March. Our West Bank correspondent Nara Hamed joined us earlier for an update on the latest Israeli raids across the occupied Palestinian territory. Let's take a listen.
The Israeli settlers attacked Palestinians inside Al-Aouja area near Ariha, where Palestinian families were just simply having a holiday. But unfortunately, the Israeli settlers attacked Palestinians over there, among many injuries occurred after being hit with rocks and after being sprayed on with poisonous pepper spray inside Al-Aouja. The IOF actually came and intruded and arrested many Palestinians in the area. Also, the Israeli settlers have attacked the village of Douma to the south of Nablus. The village of Douma has been subjected to unbelievable and such large attacks upon this small village. As local resources have reported, that there have been many cars and homes have been burned down inside Douma, with three Palestinians were injured during these clashes and during this violent attack by the Israeli settlers. So the situation from the Israeli settlers today, we have seen escalation by these attacks from the Israeli settlers, who are trying to expand and to expel Palestinians with all resources possible.
Iran has strongly condemned Israel's continued aggression against Lebanon, including Tuesday's deadly airstrike, which killed many civilians, including a Hezbollah official and his son. The foreign ministry spokesman said the regime has breached the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon over 2,000 times and violated the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Ismail Baghaei described Israel's aggression as a blatant violation of international law and human rights. He said the inaction of the ceasefire guarantors in the face of Israel's rogue behavior proves their promises lack any credibility. He also slammed the silence of international organizations, especially the UN Security Council, on Israel's heinous crimes in Lebanon and the occupied Palestine. Baghaei said the U.S. and its Western allies are complicit in Israel's crimes, calling on regional countries to take more serious action to oppose the regime's expansionist policy. We earlier talked to political analyst Bruno Biclini to get his insight on Israel's constant violations of the ceasefire deal with Lebanon. Let's take a listen.
The guarantors of the ceasefire, they kind of act as hypocrites, because Israel must be punished. If they violate the ceasefire, they would have to receive, for example, blockade and sanctions with the SWIFT system and all of the financial system controlled by the guarantors. As long as U.S. does not put pressure on Israel, and will never do this, we understand that the Arab nation and the Muslim countries, they must defend themselves. I have even another thing to say. I'm very disappointed, but it's not a surprise, with the so-called Lebanese army and Lebanese armed forces, because I said this in this channel, on this television. As far as the Lebanese forces, they are down south, and they will have the duty to protect the civilians and to expose the invaders. As long as they don't fight against the Zionist army, they force Hezbollah to get into the conflict again. And that's exactly what's happening now. Tel Aviv understand that every target is legitimate if they allow them to be a Hezbollah base or a Lebanese resistance base. And during this time, the Lebanese forces, they do almost nothing. It's the same old situation in Lebanon. And the guarantors, as long as they don't punish Israel, what are they doing and what do they serve?
The Yemeni army says it has carried out a fresh anti-U.S. operation targeting an American aircraft carrier in the Red Sea for the third time in the past 24 hours.
In response to the American aggression against our country, the naval forces, rocket forces, and the air force of our armed forces have targeted hostile warships in the Red Sea, including the American aircraft carrier USS Harry S. Truman, using several cruise missiles and drones. The engagement is ongoing at the time of this statement, marking the third such operation in the past 24 hours. Our military operations against the American enemy will continue, targeting their warships in the declared operational zone with increasing intensity, God willing.
Saleh added that Yemen's operations against Israel will also continue by preventing navigation of the regime's vessels in the Red and Arabian Seas and targeting its military and vital facilities. He stressed that anti-Israel operations will go on until the regime's genocide against the oppressed Palestinian people in Gaza stops and the siege of the territory is lifted. The United States has carried out fresh airstrikes on various areas across Yemen to make the Arab country stop its support for Palestinians in Gaza. In their latest aggression, American warplanes conducted 5 airstrikes on the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. The United States also carried out 5 air raids on Saada governorate after an earlier strike on Hodeidah. The strike on Hodeidah governorate hit the water company in the city of Al-Mansouriyah, leaving 4 people dead and several others injured. Yemen's Hadjia governorate was another target of U.S. airstrikes, where American warplanes hit the Washaa district with 3 raids. Most of U.S. attacks target civilian buildings in the Yemeni capital. Washington claims the attacks are meant to protect freedom of navigation in nearby waters. Yemen rejects the claim, saying its naval operations solely target Israel-linked ships in an attempt to stop the regime's genocide in Gaza. Iran's foreign minister has dismissed U.S. President Donald Trump's latest threats about using military force to bomb the country's nuclear sites. Abbas Araghchi asserted that there's no such thing as a military option, let alone a military solution, with regard to Iran's peaceful nuclear program. He noted that although the U.S. unilaterally withdrew from the 2015 nuclear agreement, known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, Iran has been committed to the deal. The top diplomat said there is not one shred of proof that Iran has violated its commitment under the nuclear agreement. Araghchi said Iran has reaffirmed that under no circumstances it will ever seek, develop, or acquire nuclear weapons. He also cautioned against any U.S. adventurism, saying catastrophic failures in the region have cost prior U.S. administrations more than $7 trillion. Araghchi concluded by saying that diplomatic engagement has worked in the past and can still work. His remarks followed a phone call with the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, during which he called on the UN nuclear agency to take a clear stance on threats made against Iran's nuclear sites. Journalist and political commentator Said Mohsen Abbas believes that U.S. pressure on Iran is aimed at subjugating the only powerful country in the region.
Iran is certainly a conflict. The question is really whether the Americans themselves have got the foolhardiness to go for a military option. Iran has time and time again shown its capabilities, has made it clear what military defense capabilities it has with the ballistic missiles and the various other actions that they've taken with them over the last 3 or 4 years. But of course, it's very possible that Donald Trump's establishment hasn't done this, because they're being pushed by the Zionists desperately to achieve the result, which is really what they've always had on their minds, which is the subjugation of Iran, because Iran is the only power in the region that stands for the oppressed, that remains independent, isn't bowing to the pressure of the dollar, and is also giving hope to a lot of the oppressed in the region to say that they can also one day have freedom and liberty.
An American senator has delivered the longest speech in U.S. Senate history with a marathon address that railed the policies of President Donald Trump and his administration.
In just 71 days, the President of the United States has inflicted so much harm on Americans' safety, financial stability, the core foundations of our democracy, and even our aspirations as a people for, from our highest offices, a sense of common decency.
I just want to tell you a question. Do you know you have just broken the record? Do you know how proud this caucus is of you? Do you know how proud America is of you?
Senator Cory Booker held the Senate floor for over 25 hours, breaking the record set by the late segregationist senator, Strom Thurmond. Booker's speech lasted 25 hours and 4 minutes, surpassing Thurmond's 1957 filibuster against the Civil Rights Act by 46 minutes. With only brief pauses to take questions, Booker said he intended to highlight what he called President Donald Trump's threat to U.S. democracy. He accused the Trump administration of recklessly attacking American institutions. He also criticized Trump aide Elon Musk's cuts to the federal bureaucracy, including reductions in staffing at the Social Security Administration. The European Parliament warns of a strong plan for retaliation against upcoming U.S. tariffs. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen stressed that the EU has the power to protect its people and prosperity with its vast single market and strategic leverage. She assured lawmakers that Europe will remain united in promoting its economic and geopolitical goals. The dispute is deepening as Washington considers imposing new trade barriers, with President Trump set to announce his tariff plan on Wednesday. Last year, the EU was the largest buyer of U.S. exports. Both sides face significant risks as they prepare for a possible trade standoff. And that brings us to an end here on this edition of World News. Do stay tuned, though. Bye.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Spring of Souls. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the program. The 13th day of the Iranian month of Farvardin, April 2nd, has been dubbed as the Day of Nature in the Iranian calendar. Iranians celebrate this day with going outdoors and spending the day in gardens, mountain sides, and riverbanks. It is the last day of Nowruz and is called Sizde Bedar. Stay tuned for the third and last part of the three-part program, Spring of Souls. Sizde Bedar is an ancient feast and a good opportunity to make close bond with nature and appreciate this precious divine bounty. Iranians enjoy themselves on this day alongside their families and friends. Ancient Iranians used to celebrate the first 12 days of the year in remembrance of the 12th month of the year and finished it with the 13th day in nature. This was, in fact, the beginning of the first half of the agricultural year. Children are very happy on this day as they have the chance to run and play here, free from the confinement of tiny apartments of the modern life. Kebab and chicken are among the popular foods on this day, but other foods are also prepared for the event. Ash is among the foods which is usually found on this day. It is a special kind of broth which is made with vegetables and a special type of noodles or other ingredients. Kuku sabzi is also popular among Iranian families. This food is made with fried vegetables and eggs. However, Sizde Bedar is not limited to foods. People, especially young ones and adolescents, spend part of their time in games such as volleyball, badminton, and national and local games. Moreover, in many regions of the country, families and friends converge to prepare ash together. This food is made in a large pot. Collective games are also common among Iranians on the 13th of Farvardin. Some of them are local ones like
haft sang, meaning seven stones, while others are globally played games like volleyball. Dear listeners, people in other countries such as Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, India and Pakistan also go to the nature on the 13th of Farvardin. They have ceremonies like Iranians. In Tajikistan, whose culture is close with that of Iran, Nowruz ceremonies continue till the 13th day. The Tajik people spend their day in nature and prepare traditional foods and play local games. Although this day has no specific name in Tajikistan, the people in this country have customs similar to Iranians. In Azerbaijan, too, Nowruz traditions are like those of Iran, but there is no specific ceremony like Sizde Bedar of Iran. However, people go to the nature in the days after Nowruz. In the north of India and in Pakistan, there are traditions similar to Iran as a result of the impact of the Iranian Sizde Bedar. People go to the nature, but this day has not been officially registered in their calendar. Sizde Bedar is an opportunity for being with each other and entertaining beside one another. It is the time to appreciate the beauties of nature and be thankful of God for granting us infinite blessings. Sizde Bedar reminds us that life is short and transient. It teaches us to respect nature and coexist with it kindly and attentively. It warns us that the health of nature results in our health. On the contrary, if nature is sick, we will be sick. Nature belongs not only to us, but to the next generations. So, it is a crime to break a twig or burn a tree. It would be irreparable to ruin a bird's nest or an animal's burrow. Sizde Bedar can teach us that nature is a divine trust, and we should deliver it to our children and grandchildren. Our happiness depends on the happiness of nature. Today is the day to renew your pledge with nature. It is the day to learn from nature, to be kind and generous to others. Sizde Bedar, the day of nature, is a time to teach the younger ones to protect the nature and not let anyone destroy its beauties or be heedless of its bounties. In short, today is the day to feel responsible towards nature and deem it a sacred creature.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kHz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you. Black and white.
En América Latina, incluso en España y en algunos otros países,
in Latin America, as well as in Spain and a few other countries, a phenomenon has emerged that some scholars refer to as illegal warfare or lawfare.
Algo nuevo.
This concept is considered new by these scholars, perhaps because they overlook the fundamental structure of states. States cannot be divided into parts where one part controls the other.
No se pueden dividir por parte y decir que una parte está para controlar la otra.
A state is a unified entity with essential pillars such as the armed forces, the judiciary, and the parliament.
Fuerzas armadas, la corte o poder judicial, parlamentario.
All working together to uphold the model of society that that state has.
Ese estado tiene. Entonces, es algo sorprendente.
So it is somewhat surprising that the elitist courts at the service of the dominant classes in Latin America act against those who maintain political positions of a democratic nature.
Posiciones políticas de carácter democrática.
Progressive in the good sense of progressivism, a healthy progressivism.
Estamos hablando de aquel progresismo que no tiene nombre nada más. Es algo que alguien podría llamar la atención.
We're not talking about that progressivism that has no name. Is this not something worth noting? At some point, an oppressive state is supported by boots, by the military, at other times by ballet shoes, by the courts.
Con lo que son las cortes judiciales. A través de las cortes judiciales se van.
Through the courts, government like Cristina Kirchner's in Argentina,
Rafael Correa's
in Ecuador, and Lula da Silva's in Brazil have faced challenges.
In Brazil y otros lados. Es algo entonces que debemos de tenerlo en cuenta.
This is something we need to keep in mind. The fight for social transformation must encompass all aspects and carry all banners. A state resembles an octopus with tentacles that control the entire situation.
toda la situación. Uno de ellos, muy fuerte.
One of those arms, a very strong one, is the judicial power. A judicial power that looks inward and reproduces itself in an undemocratic way.
Muchas de las cortes.
Even in Latin America, many courts have seen little change except for the passing of judges who were part of the era of military dictatorships that plagued our region. Can anyone truly believe that justice exists as a common good for all? This isn't just about social justice. Of course, it also has to do with that. This does not exist. Just as it is necessary to change the nature of governments in relation to the armed forces, the character of the judiciary must also be transformed if we want sovereignty, independence, and development in the peoples and countries of Latin America. Let no one be fooled. The judiciary is not neutral. It is not merely a counterbalance to the executive and legislative powers, as some legal scholars claim. That perspective belongs to academia and those who support the system. But it has little to do with the practical realities of people's lives. Lawfare is a tool that I have also seen used by imperialism that targets social and political leaders who are striving for change. This is Black and White. I'm Eduardo Artes.
Soy Eduardo Artes. La forma de ejercer el poder, los estados.
The ways in which power is exercised by states have always been multifaceted. They utilize military, economic, and legal means. Sometimes military force is the primary method for addressing issues, while at other times, legal avenues are pursued. Currently, due to various contradictions, particularly the weakness of popular movements, it's not the military that is taking charge, but rather the so-called soft coups through legal warfare or lawfare, as it is known. To discuss this topic, we have a special guest from Argentina, Silvina Romano. She's a prominent researcher and academic, serving as the coordinator of the Lawfare Observatory, which focuses on the study and analysis of judicial warfare in Latin America. With a doctorate in political science, her research primarily examines the relationships between the United States and Latin America, along with issues related to democracy, security, and the use of legal strategies as political tools. Silvina Romano, welcome to Black and White.
Bienvenida, Silvina Romano, a Negro y Blanco.
Hola a todas y todos.
Hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you.
What characteristics has this hybrid legal war, known as lawfare, taken on, Silvina? It would be great if you could help us understand where the term comes from, especially in the context of Latin America. How does it manifest itself?
The
main point I want to make is about how the judiciary, particularly its supreme courts, shapes political dynamics. How does this happen? There are numerous legal actions taken against certain political sectors, leaders, and parties that have a chance of winning elections. By filing these lawsuits and bringing them to the media's attention, it creates a sort of spectacle around these legal accusations, effectively preventing these individuals and groups from participating in the electoral process. This is the general idea. Where does this concept originate? It seems to define the current situation. It's a term used in the United States, originally coined by an American military figure to describe how soft power tools, rather than force or weapons, can be employed to intimidate opponents and persuade them to withdraw from their struggles. One of the key tools in this context, known as lawfare, is particularly noteworthy. Economic sanctions play a significant role in shaping international relations. They can be used strategically to influence countries like Iran and Venezuela, and to severely impact economies such as Cuba's, ultimately aiming to undermine their sovereignty and force compliance. This is a broad overview of the situation. The focus here is on how the judicial system and media power are leveraged to marginalize certain political groups, effectively removing them from the political landscape. As a result, when you go to vote, your options are limited because these individuals may be facing legal issues, imprisonment, or preventive detention. Consequently, the judicial system, along with media and social networks, shapes the political agenda.
La agenda política.
¿A ti no te parece que también es un poco...
Don't you think that there are also some misconceptions among liberal sectors when a democratic struggle for workers' rights and social change begins? They often overlook the fact that the judiciary and courts are crucial pillars of the capitalist state, which in many Latin American countries are heavily influenced by U.S. imperialism. Additionally, these judges operate without any popular oversight. For instance, in Chile and likely in Argentina as well, judges have not been removed. Instead, they have been replaced using the same methods. And we still see the same courts that date back to the time of Pinochet's fascist military dictatorship.
It seems you've hit the nail on the head regarding the issue at hand. Among all branches of power, the judicial system is arguably the least democratic. Just think about it. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, how often did we discuss the judiciary? Not very much at all. Back then, it was largely unknown. Now, names like Sergio Moro ring a bell for many of us, especially since he gained notoriety for imprisoning Lula. In the last couple of decades, we've witnessed a significant rise in the visibility of the judicial system. We see them on TVs, we hear about them on the radio. Why is that? Because it is taking over the agenda. We are talking about a highly conservative right-wing judicial power, as you pointed out. Why? Because when it comes to these courts, there is no replacement. Why is there no replacement? Because the judicial systems often represent our oligarchies or privileged minorities. Becoming a Supreme Court judge isn't just about having a good law degree. It's more about families and a sort of corporate network that perpetuates itself within this power structure. They reproduce themselves. It's important to note that while the judiciary has always influenced government decisions, it didn't have the same level of visibility and presence that it does today. Take someone like Diana Salazar in Ecuador, for instance. She's in the news every day. Remember what I said about Sergio Moro? They become celebrities in the political arena. This shows how the media and the judiciary are increasingly intertwining with politics, leading to a distortion of what politics should be.
That's right, Silvina. We'll take a quick break and be back in just a moment.
We're
back here with Silvina Romano. Silvina, you were sharing some insights about the interplay between the dominant media outlets and the interests of big capital, which the states in Latin America are part of, essentially the owners of this big capital. You also mentioned the role of the media and the courts. There is an intriguing aspect to consider. The courts often present themselves to the public as neutral entities. They project a somewhat saintly image, suggesting they rise above politics and contradictions, solely focused on delivering justice. But what kind of justice is that? Are they truly neutral, or do they serve political interests? Who appoints the judges?
It's important to highlight that every branch of the state is inherently involved in politics. The state is fundamentally a political organization. So to claim that it is apolitical is quite a simplistic way to describe any governmental power. It simply doesn't hold up. What we should focus on is that these powers should not be tied to any specific political party. Ideally, they are meant to deliver justice impartially. But why is that the expectation? If we consider that these judicial elites represent a privileged minority, we must ask whose interests they truly serve. Are they representing the interests of the people? It's worth noting that much of the political persecution through the judicial system has been against progressive sectors. So what do we mean by progressivism? Governments or political sectors that advocate for state intervention in the economy aim to redistribute resources for the historically marginalized minority in Latin America, particularly during the 1980s. So what do these minorities represent? They don't represent or care about the everyday people. It's not a matter of being good or bad. It's about serving other interests. They cater to corporate agendas and belong to families that lead transnational lives, existing in a world far removed from that of ordinary citizens. They are not interested in judicial processes related to, let's say, battered homes, abandoned, or battered children. No, that's not what motivates them. Well, what drives them then? Their focus is on supporting large corporations and, above all, hindering processes where the state is taking over. To what end? To define and redefine concepts like sovereignty, autonomy, and the redistribution of resources, particularly those that are strategic in nature. To what end? To define and redefine concepts like sovereignty, autonomy, and the redistribution of resources, particularly those that are strategic in nature. The judiciary is politicized, favoring a privileged minority. Okay, now here is the question. Where do our judges receive their training? I'm not sure if I should continue, but it's crucial because most of the training often comes from regional organizations like the OAS, Organization of American States, or they attend courses in the United States. It's not that these programs are inherently bad. It's just that they are the available options that can help advance one's career, and that's widely accepted. The real question is, why should the framework and action plans for our judicial systems, judges, and prosecutors come from the United States, when the needs and history of our population are so different? Exactly. This seems to be one of the key issues worth discussing.
It's similar to the relationship that the armed forces of our countries have with them. The United States train military officers and also judges. Everything is interconnected, like a giant octopus with various arms. Look, López Obrador attempted some reforms within the constraints of liberalism, particularly in the judicial branch, which is a significant aspect. In Venezuela, at the local level, there is also a process for the direct election of judges, specifically at the parish level. However, in Mexico, the situation was more complex, with strong contradictions arising. The judicial branch strongly opposed these changes. What can you share about that effort to alter the nature of the system, even though the fundamental nature can't change without a shift in the overall system?
I believe it's positive on two fronts. One aspect is the democratization of the judiciary, and I find the experience unfolding in Mexico to be quite fascinating. Initially, the focus was on reducing the privileges of the court, which had exorbitant salaries and outrageous benefits in a society marked by significant inequality. I think they have rightly placed their attention on this issue, and it's a positive step forward. Now, the question is, what does this minority in the judiciary represent? We find ourselves in societies that are extremely unequal. If we don't address the structural inequalities, no matter how many reforms we implement in state powers, we will continue to sustain a privileged minority that survives inflation, neoliberal policies, and the selling off of nations. This group manages to survive. The issue with our judicial systems is that they perpetuate these structural inequalities. In other words, the privileged minority within the judiciary reflects these disparities. We can work towards democratizing this power by allowing people to vote for judges, but we must also change the underlying structural and economic conditions. There needs to be a shift in the relationship between the structure and those in power. How do we achieve this? It seems to me that this is somewhat what is being attempted in Mexico.
That's right. It's very hard for the people to have control over the courts if they don't have control over the entire state, given the very nature of a capitalist state. Can we say that lawfare also highlights the limitations of liberal democracy? It's definitely a topic worth discussing, isn't it? It seems like liberal democracy is often seen as a quick fix for everything.
I find it incredibly interesting to focus on this issue because do you know who is revealing the limits of liberal democracy? It's the rising far-right movements that are coming to power through democratic means. This situation highlights the limits of liberal democracy. It pushes progressive sectors to define what democracy should truly encompass. Simply going to vote isn't enough. We need democracies that are substantive with economic, political, social, and cultural inclusion, elements that the far right in Argentina, especially influenced by Trump, are currently rejecting. The judiciary is one of the branches where these far right groups stand firm, as they are part of the broader right wing agenda. So I think the challenge today is to give substance, to give flesh to this democracy, and to recognize that what Latin America needs is social justice. Without social justice, it becomes challenging to discuss democracy in a meaningful or profound way.
That's right, we have elitist courts that obey the elite, and they see this as just. For them, it feels justifiable because they view our current situation filled with inequalities, exploitation, discrimination, and widespread poverty across our continent as normal. Which cases of lawfare have caught your attention the most in Latin America? One or two, perhaps?
Uno de ellos, o dos, no sé.
El de Ecuador.
The one in Ecuador. I think the one in Ecuador seems to be less visible compared to the Lava Jato scandal in Brazil, which received significant attention and is indeed important. The one in Ecuador in recent years has been a total persecution against Correism, against any political sector that doesn't kneel directly before the de facto power of the United States, which wants to make Ecuador one of the economic and military bases of operations in the region. What's happening is quite serious. The state is undergoing rapid deinstitutionalization. There's a scorched earth tactic at play, allowing cartels to operate freely, which creates a dire situation of poverty and makes it nearly impossible for young people to build a decent life. This has resulted in a wave of Ecuadorian migration as people are forced to leave their homeland due to a lack of dignified living conditions. The narrative justifying these actions has been framed as a fight against corruption. No, let's not be fooled. Corruption is a significant issue faced by governments around the globe. In Latin America, the real challenge lies in structural inequality, a lack of investment, and inadequate infrastructure. There are people living in conditions reminiscent of the 19th century, and while we will address corruption, we must also recognize that many children are going without a meal each day. Thousands in our countries. We need to prioritize these issues as the left has always advocated, equality first, access to a decent life, and then we look at all the other issues, right?
Perhaps one example of what you're suggesting about Ecuador is the situation with the embassy. How did that go unnoticed and the courts remain silent? And now, in practice, the vice president's dismissal.
Absolutely. Take a look here. I'll also share the link to the book, Lawfare in Ecuador, War Against Democracy and Law. It details the case of Jorge Glass, who is recognized as a significant example of lawfare on an international scale. The Ecuadorian government disregarded legal boundaries and international diplomatic norms without hesitation. This sets a concerning precedent as it jeopardizes the right to asylum for everyone, which is extremely serious. And you know what happened? We're working to ensure this issue gains attention in international organizations and resonates widely. But Jorge Glass remains imprisoned, unjustly and illegally.
Así es. Jorge Glass sigue preso.
The camera is set aside, the courts are quiet, and everyone is in high spirits. Silvina Romano, we have reached the end, and we truly appreciate it. Thank you so much for being here on Black and White.
You're very welcome, and thank you. Let's keep fighting together.
Así es.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm Atta, the host of this program. This series of the program Viewpoints is mainly concerned with the speeches and thoughts of the supreme leader of Iran, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, also known as Imam Khamenei. With me in the studio are two guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Shaykh Ali and Sayyid Mohsen. Sayyid Mohsen, assalamu alaikum, welcome to the show.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, thanks for inviting.
So, and Shaykh Ali, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So, very recently, in one of the speeches of Imam Khamenei, he talked about a very important concept, which is Jihad al-Tabyin. And so many people in Iran, inside Iran and outside Iran, were shocked by this, we can say, type of look at the world and at the concept of jihad. Because this is the first time that this term has been coined by the rahbar and he used it. So now there are so many, we can say, explanations, commentaries and interpretations written on this concept. Of course, rahbar in his speech gave us a very nice framework for Jihad al-Tabyin. But this is good to be more familiar with this concept, maybe for the English-speaking people all around the world through this radio show, Viewpoints. Even inside the Islamic land, the key holders of the Kaaba and the Mecca, I mean the Wahhabis and all these kings over there, okay, are hand in hand with the enemy of Islam. So is it at all true to say that Islamic Republic of Iran is alone? Or no, maybe this Jihad al-Tabyin can also attract some people out of the borders of Islam. For example, Christians, Jews, those who are after the social justice, justice seekers across the world, those people who believe in the concept of the last savior, for example. Okay, what's your answer to that?
Well, I think because the Islamic revolution was based on the pure Mohammedan Islam, and the difference between this country, which is Iran, obviously we know it as the Islamic revolutionary country, not the Iran, the state only the, as in Iran.
Okay.
It's a revolutionary country and it's an Islamic revolutionary country. Therefore, we can see that because the main aim was to gain Islam, to have Islam in this country, to apply the pure Mohammedan Islam in this country. That's why we can see it is on the front foot. And we clearly see Iran being engaged with all these things.
Yes.
But on the other hand, we cannot say it is just Iran. Other people, other countries are also involved, not at the government level. For example, you know, whenever something happens to the against the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam or the Quran, the very first people which we see who have you know, protests and all those things, it always happens in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people themselves, not the government. I'm not talking about the governments right now.
Yes.
Within the people, we can see, and the Supreme Leader also has said, the belief that the Pakistani Muslims have, they have a firm belief on the Quran and the Prophet.
Yes.
You know, if someone says anything to the Prophet or the Quran, they, according to their beliefs, they do protest. whether it's happened in the France or in any other part of the world, they stand against it. So we can see people doing that, but because the governments are not sincere, because the governments are following the, you know, the strategy that are set by the capitalist, by the capitalism.
Yes.
They are following a different system within the Islamic State, and they just have the name of the Islamic State. That's why we cannot see these countries, these governments, or the rulers of these countries being with the you know, on the front foot.
Yes.
On the other hand, we can see, like, for example, the example that you gave for the Ahle Saud and all those.
Yes.
they're just pretending to be the Muslims, you know. The land which was free of the idols, which was free out of the, you know, all the non-Islamic rituals and all those things, they are just doing that again. They just brought that again. They're like killing people. They finance ISIS. You know, all these things. This shows that they're not the true followers of Islam, but they are the puppets who have been, you know, plotted mm-hmm. in these countries.
Yes.
And we know that there's a term which is used in the Quran, and it can be used in all the times for the enemies, and that is taghut,
mm-hmm.
rebels.
Yes.
Taghut is a good term for all the
yes.
times.
Aggressors.
You know? So we can use this term for anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And as we know that Imam Khomeini also mentioned that the America is the big Saturn.
Yeah, Shaitan.
And the Shaitan Bozorg, big Saturn. How it is doing, what it is doing, what he has done to the, you know, again, because we're talking about the current affairs as well, we have this. I have to take the name of Ukraine again.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was what the Prime Minister of Ukraine
yes.
himself claimed
yeah.
that Iran and the other countries